I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. We're back with another episode of The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. I'm joined today by author Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, author of Friday Black, which is our pick for the Stacks Book Club this Wednesday, February 27th. As you know, The Stacks is a completely free show, and if you want to help be part of making this show happen every single week, I encourage you to check out joining the effort on Patreon. Patreon is a website where you contribute to the work we're doing on the show for as little as $1 a month. Patreon allows for us to launch new content like these short stacks. The fun thing about Patreon is that you get perks in return for your generosity. My personal favorite perk is our virtual book club, where we meet to discuss the Stacks Book Club picks through video chat. It's a great way to connect with the awesome community of readers. If you're interested in being a part of the Stacks Pack community, go to patreon.com/thestacks. And Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. If you prefer one-time contributions, check out paypal.me/thestackspod. Please do me a huge favor and rate and review the show. The word is building around the Stacks, and the more ratings and reviews we get, the more people we can reach, which means new exciting guests, better audio quality, and more giveaways. If you would take a few minutes wherever you're listening, especially on Apple Podcasts, and leave a rating and review. Okay, now it's time for the Short Stacks. I'm super excited for you all to meet our guest, author Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. All right, y'all, I am here today with our episode of The Short Stacks with author Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, the author of our book for this week, Friday Black. Nana, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to do it.
Oh, well, we're really excited you're here. We're just going to dive right in. So the first question I always ask is, in about 30 seconds or less, tell us about Friday Black.
Okay, I have like a sort of pre-prepared
thing
about this. not knowing you were going to ask me that, but just because it's a collection of stories, right? So it's kind of hard to sort of pin it down. And now all that preface has made it more than 30 seconds. So start the timer here. It's kind of like if three people were sitting on a couch and the first one is like, you know, I think this is really nice. It's really comfortable. And the second's like, yeah, I agree. You know, great butt feel, good lumbar support. And the third is sort of like, I agree, it's pretty comfortable, but I think we're ignoring the fact that it's made out of corpses. I think the book is sort of like that. It's a collection of short stories.
weirdly works.
Yeah, but to be more specific, it's the stories that are concerned with the different ways people deny each other humanity, whether that be by racialized lines or through hyper-consumerism. And also sometimes the story is just about Family.
Okay. Well, it's definitely kind of like a couch of corpses and kind of like the second part, but I think the couch of corpses is good.
That's a better way to say it.
That feels like weirdly right, and it probably shouldn't, but that speaks to kind of my next question, which is, when you were growing up, were you always like the kid with the insane imagination in the group?
You know, I think my group of friends that I grew up with, we all had like pretty good imaginations. We used to keep stories up serially, just orally, like serial stories that we keep up orally. So like we kind of all had to be sort of trained in like remembering places and just trying to be interesting in our mind's eye. And so I feel like we all were sort of like that. I think actually compared to some of my friends, I was a little bit more reserved about and like talking about like, oh, this is what I imagine and this is what I think of.
Yeah, because as I was reading the book, I kept being like, whoa, whose brain works like this? Like, your brain is magical.
Thank you. That's nice. I mean, everybody's brain is kind of magical. I think mine is just, luckily, people are getting to see it right now.
Yeah, it's just, for me, your brain works really different than mine. So reading your words, I was like having this experience of I'm reading this story or these stories, but I'm also thinking like, wow, where did he come up with this? Because a lot of the book feels like it's inspired by current events like Trayvon Martin and other events that have kind of inspired the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's been in the zeitgeist and in the air for, I don't know, like the last probably like 7 or 8 years at this point, that whole movement. And to think that this is kind of like what you created with that was really exciting for me as someone who is interested in that, but never would have thought to go the Finkelstein 5 direction or the Zimmerland direction.
Yeah, I think for somehow I've just had a way of the absurdity, the insanity when I'm kind of hurt. I think it's like a protection. I kind of go to sort of humor or funny places. I mean, kind of whenever I'm feeling anything, but definitely when I don't know what to do, I think making a joke is sort of my way often, or not exactly a joke, but saying something funny. And to my kind of horror, but not really horror, someone recently posted a video on Twitter a long time ago of me that I had made sort of in response to Trayvon Martin being murdered. And I was like pretending to be this professor that was like, his name was like W.T. Fridgman or something. And his initials were like WTF, you know? Mm. And he was parroting Geraldo Rivera, who had said, "Don't blame racism, blame this hoodie for him being murdered." And it was like it ended up being like a very ridiculous character. It was kind of funny. It was stupid and kind of crazy. I don't know. Something about that form helps me get my point across, I think, a lot easier.
Right. A little satire.
Yeah.
And kind of mocking.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely.
So obviously I kind of gave a little bit about the book, but where did your ideas come from for this book? Like, what inspired you to actually sit down and write it as opposed to kind of goofing off with your friends or making videos and stuff?
Well, you know, I think the thing about writing is, I like it a lot because it's free. Mm-hmm. When I made that video, I did it on my friend's camera, one of my really good friend's camera. I couldn't afford a camera. And I say jokingly, but sort of honestly, like, you know, reading through the library is free. I had the kind of parents who would drop you off the library when it opened and kind of pick you up when it closed. I found comfort in books from an early age. I learned to love them. And I learned to love writing in a similar way. When I didn't like what was going on around me, I could write. And sometimes I didn't have my friends around me. So, you know, now it's just me and a piece of paper, or like one of my dad's legal pads. I think, for something about me is I do like, if I get committed to something, I like something sort of tangible. So I like the feeling of, you know, I wrote a chapter today. The satisfaction of I feel after having just written something is like really, really intoxicating, you know? And so I just learned to love that feeling, and I continued chasing it, and I started to see progress, and I continued, and luckily I got encouraged at the right places, and I sort of just stayed with it.
Yeah. Well, kind of in that same vein, how do you know when you're done?
You know, I think you have to just decide, this is where, at this point, as far as I can take it, because, you know, if I had a chance, I'd probably revise every single story in this first book. I think you have to sort of decide about, like, where I'm at now as a person, where I'm at now as an artist, where this story is at now as a entity on its own, and, you know, let it go off to school, you know, let it go off to be in the world. It's hard. It isn't easy because you're trying to chase this feeling that this like sort of perfectness that isn't really real, or I don't know that it exists exactly, but you know, you have to, I think you have to sort of just, it's like sort of a leap of faith.
Right. Well, yeah. I guess, and to that same end, where did you start with this book? Because obviously it's a collection of stories, so I'm assuming, you know, one story came before the other, but how did you, like, I guess literally, where did you start writing? How did you start writing it? And then also, how did you decide what story would start the collection?
First, like how the very, very first story, I want to say I was in college. I had just written a couple of stories that my professor, Lynn Tillman, liked. And neither of those stories is in this book. But I was like, you know, getting more and more serious about trying to be a writer. I'd applied to the MFA at Syracuse. And, you know, I kind of wanted to try to get a chance to use my real life. So I think I wrote the story in retail. A story very different from the one that's here. A version that's different. Then I think, as is the case with me and as kind of allowed this book to be, I also have like this other part of me that's really like likes to be a lot, that like deals with difficulty in a way less literal way and a way more sort of around the bend kind of way. And especially when I don't know exactly how to process, sometimes I just mirror exactly what I feel like I'm feeling. As is the case with like the blackness scale, you know, I chose, sometimes I just, I'll literalize and concretize something that I'm feeling abstractly, you know? And so that's how you kind of get the blackness scale on the Finkelstein Five. But then I think the next story I wrote after the Finkelstein Five was Lark Street, actually.
Oh.
And I think I wrote it and I sort of felt like, oh no, this is dumb or you can't do this. And I just sort of left it alone. And then I spent the next couple of years in the MFA sort of trying to figure out, do I write these kind of stories? Do I write that kind of story? Do I write these kind of stories? Do I write that kind of story? I asked, working with George, who was my thesis advisor for the manuscript that would become this book, you know, I kind of like tried to get him to tell me like, which kind of writer should I be, you know? Mm. And he was, I was like, should I write like realistic? Should I write like these realistic stories? Should I do these more surreal sort of weird satire stuff? You know, should I do this kind of that? And he was sort of just like, yes, you know, I'm really glad for that because I think that's kind of one of the things I like about this book and write about, and one of the things I like about myself as a writer is, I don't feel bound to any one particular thing.
I mean, it definitely comes through that way. In the interest of full disclosure, we already recorded the episode where we talk about your book. It's interesting to hear you say some of the things that we picked up on and then also hear you say things that I hadn't really thought about. And I'm like, oh, shoot, I wish I could go back and have that conversation again. Oh,
and it reminds me, oh, sorry, and I forgot to say the second part of your question, which was the Finkelstein Five. When I wrote the Finkelstein Five, though, that's when I sort of a bunch of back and forth congealed. And it might have been the very next story after those first two that I wrote, or at least started. It took me longer than any other story I've ever written to write. But I think when I got it, I was like, this is something I can do, me specifically. This is something I think that I can do that I don't think another writer can do.
Yeah.
And but I think, and more importantly though, like I was in college when Trayvon Martin was murdered. Me and my friend, the same friend whose camera I borrowed to make that video I was talking about earlier, we made these pamphlets to sort of, I don't know, scream from the mountaintops about the injustice of Trayvon's being murdered. And we made like 500 and we spread them around the campus in the middle of the night, or like 5, 4, let's say 3 in the morning. And I went to sleep thinking like, you know, great, you know, I fixed racism. And, you know, I did this pamphlet anonymously, but I still felt really good about it. And I woke up, you know, expecting to see like a whole bunch of change. Everything is like, I wanted, you know, some kind of big upheaval. Nothing happened. And I didn't like that. But when I did write the Finkelstein Five story, I felt that same feeling that is like, I wanted it to be out in the world, even if no one knew my name was attached. I thought it was like something important. And so for me, Finkelstein Five was, it really just had to be the first story in this book, because I figure if people read one thing of mine and nothing else, I wanted it to be that story.
Wow, I love that.
So yeah, that's why it's the first story. Because, you know, maybe they'd be like, well, that was dumb and just put it down. But at least, you know, maybe I would have hit someone a little bit.
Do you get a lot of good response on the Finkelstein Five?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a story that, you know, your first story in your first book, I think I do get a lot of good overt response to it. But in some ways, just because of the way people consume content, I think that this book's success in a lot of ways is that story's success. You know, people sort of are quick to judge things. And I think that story starting the way it also sort of it frames the way people think of me as a writer. Now it's like, you know, I don't only do the surreal thing, but because of that, like that's what people focus on because that's the first story. And race is something I talk about explicitly. And because of the way I do that in that first story, it's almost like I'm a race writer now, you know?
Sure, but I hate that.
Yeah, it's a limiting thing, and it's a conscious decision. I think in some ways, I mean, I didn't realize how much that was going to be a thing.
Right,
but I don't mind it because I think the story is important. But, you know, if I would say the first story would have been Friday Black, the title story, I think people would read the whole entire book very differently.
Totally, because it's what sets it up. It's what sets you up. But how did you decide to use Friday Black as the title then?
I was strongly encouraged by my publisher to not I wanted to be the title. No, it was going to be called something else. It was going to be called How to Sell a Jacket.
Okay.
Which again, like for me is, you know, it's a much quieter, but I think they were right. There was a lot of how-to books at the time, like literary how-to, like books that are not how-to books that use the how-to title. So I think it was like a way to step out. And I think my agent, Meredith Kafel-Simonoff, I had thought of the idea of Friday Black prior to even when it was actually a manuscript, but I went with How to Sell a Jacket, and then we ended with Friday Black after discussing it for a little bit.
Interesting.
A little bit of a stronger title.
Yeah.
Punchy and aggressive, I mean.
Yeah. And it fills the cover really beautifully. Like the way that it looks on the cover is like the perfect size and shape.
Yeah. And by calling it the Friday Black thing, though, you kind of on a weird, like, I don't know, just on like a word level, you get some of the How to Sell a Jacket thing, that resonance of like, you know, consumerism, and then just on a baseline level, I'm sure just on some people's reading, just the word black being the title is something.
Totally. You know? That's so right on. Speaking of the cover is from another story, the imagery. How did you decide? Like, I'm just really fascinated kind of how this all came to be, because I'm not really a huge short story reader. I haven't been, but in the last year or so, there have been some really great collections, including yours, that have come out. And so now I'm thinking about short story collections and also essays in a different way, because your work, it's not one, while you have themes that are consistent, it's not one thing. It's a lot of things. So how do you draw, like, how did you decide that was the story that would be the imagery?
There's so many different great short story collections this year. And I like that you say that, because I'm really happy to be like come out the same year as like Jemele Brinkley and the Feast of Thompson Spires.
Oh my God, so good.
Yeah, Heads of the Colored People. I think it's a beautiful book.
Lucky Man.
Yeah, they're the real deal. And it's like kind of an honor to be out in the same kind of time as them.
Yeah.
As them both. But, you know, actually, again, I got super lucky. The designer at Houghton Mifflin read the book. He really liked the book. And that's what he came up with. Wow. And I saw it and I was happy right away. I had just driven from the city to back up to Syracuse through like a crazy blizzard in a car that shouldn't be driving in the snow. And I was like, I saw the email from my agent, but I couldn't check it because I was like trying not to spin out all on the highway. And I got home, I opened the attachment that had the cover, and I couldn't. It was interesting because I didn't know what it was at first, because, you know, your eye kind of must go straight to the middle. And I was like, I see like strings. What is this? And then, like, you know, I had this effect of seeing the full thing, and I really, really, really liked it. I really, really loved it, actually.
I had that same experience when I had the book in my hand. I never really looked at the cover seriously. And the book came out in October, and I think I got it in November. Like, I've had it for a while, and I just read it last week. And in the process of reading it, I got to that story, and I was like, oh, I feel like there was a spider on the cover. Let me look at that again. And then I was like, you're an idiot. How did you miss that?
Yeah, I like it because it's subtle, but also bold. You know what I mean? Like, which, again, like for me, I feel like, The guy's name is Mark Robinson. He really just did a great job. And with the lion, the spider thing, I like that as well, because then besides the resonances of the retail / consumerism thing and, I don't know, the black thing, you kind of get some of the like sort of the heritage thing as well with the cover too. So I felt like altogether, I love – like I don't love a lot of book covers, but I actually like got really – I know I got lucky with my book cover. I love it.
Well, you might not have gotten lucky. You might have just had a really good team.
Mark Robinson just did his thing completely. Yeah. He really, really killed it.
I love that. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I do have to ask you, so I oftentimes will open up to my listeners to ask questions. And one of my listeners, Reggie, he had mentioned that he could kind of feel influences or callbacks to both Parable of the Sower and Song of Solomon. Mm-hmm. And were you influenced by some other writers that you kind of were giving shout outs to?
Yeah, I think I know you're talking about Reggie Reeves on Instagram. Yep. I think I've seen mm-hmm. him. Yeah. You know, what's crazy is I wasn't consciously sort of paying homage to Song of Solomon, which is a book I love, and I think Toni Morrison is everything. Mm-hmm. But I know I was influenced by like the 7 days. I had to have been, you know.
Right.
But I didn't consciously do it, which is crazy. Cause like by the time the book was done and I was thinking, and I don't know, someone else had brought it up, one of my friends who had read it in MFA. And I was like, oh, you know, like sometimes you don't even know where you're right. getting your stuff from. But so that one for sure. The other one not so much, but that yes. I didn't do it consciously, but I know I was influenced by the great Toni Morrison.
Yes, that she's just like inherently part of you as a writer is kind of a nice thing to think about, that you just are giving her love without knowing.
I hope I am, you know, because she is the best of the best.
Yeah. Okay. So here we go. These are some of my favorite questions. One of which is, who was the first person you let read this book? So not like your agent and the people who worked with you on it, but like when it was done, who were you like, you need to read this?
And not like George either.
Not your advisors or people who kind of read it through the process, but more like when it was finished.
Okay. And I'm pretty like close to the chest with my writing stuff. It might have been like more than my best friend, like my brother, Danny. I think I sent him a good amount of it.
Okay.
If not all of it. And sometimes what I do is, you know what I mean? I think I like sometimes send different stories to different people.
That makes
sense. But I want to say my friend Danny got maybe the first non-like writer person to see the whole thing.
That's very cool. I just always love to hear that because I know that sharing your work, obviously like your process, you know, you have a writer's group or you have advisors and things and they see you throughout the process and that's kind of their relationship. But then when it becomes ready to like share with other people who aren't as involved in the process, like that moment.
Yeah, it's scary. And it's a scary process. And I mean, also for me, like I'm just generally like, I rather really, really wait a while before I get into that place. But I want, it's hard to like put your stuff out there like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. How do you decide to name your characters? Where do those names come from?
It's so hard. I don't know. It's so hard. I struggle with it. Sometimes one thing, so like with like Amma, in the last story, mm-hmm. I wanted a cool ass like young girl that you couldn't make her white, basically. Mm. You know, or I want her to be like her, she's like, you by her name, you know she's like, she's got a name by her name. And it's not like necessarily a part of the story in a way that I think it like had to be, but like it's a name that you maybe don't always see, but for me, I do. You know, my name is Nana. My little sister's name is Efwa. My older sister's name is Adoma. And those kind of names rarely are in the literature that isn't overtly exploring, I don't know, whatever kind of immigrant experience or whatever you want to, whatever it is. Right. You know, so sometimes I do that. Other than that, I just struggle. It's hard.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it has to be hard because you're like, oh, well, I don't want that person to think I'm writing about them, but like, I need a Becky.
Yeah, well, sometimes I do it actually like on a, to be like a little like shout out. I gave one of my friends a little shout out with the last name and what in this book, you know, so.
Nice. I have a friend who wrote his first book and my name is in it. And I literally was like, everybody, I'm famous, I'm in a book. So I'm sure your friend appreciated it.
Why not give because I forgot to put him in the acknowledgements and I should have. So when I got a revision chance, I changed this name. So yeah,
I love that. That's awesome. What kind of stuff were you, Nana, reading, listening to, watching while you were writing these stories?
Like everything, because I was in the MFA.
Okay.
I was getting exposed to. I read Gail Jones for the first time. There's like so much stuff that I can't even think of like anything. I was reading my peers' work a lot. I was reading some books that I remember well from the time, Texaco, and another book called Corregidora, and just so much stuff. Like it's like stacks and stacks of stuff. If I get like my Instagram, I used to take pictures of the stacks of from that time. But I was reading more widely than I ever had at any time before, you know. I read Black Boy for the first time then. I read a lot of people for the first time, but I was reading poetry for the first time really seriously. I was reading memoir more than I had previously. At that time is when I read the work of people who became my friends and mentors, like Dana Spiota and Arthur Flowers and Bruce Smith and, you know, people up in Cuse. So yeah, I was reading a lot and also a lot of different things.
That's so cool. And I'm sure that also informed kind of how you were writing, like that you might be influenced in a moment and be like, oh, let me try that. Let me throw that in.
Absolutely. And it's all over the place with it and really getting it. That's when I first read. It's not the first time I read ZZ Packer, but I read ZZ Packer. I read Bolaño for the first time. I read a lot. Yeah, just a lot.
I love that. That's so exciting. Do you have rituals around food or beverage or just traditions or habits that you do around your own writing? Like when you sit down to write, where you go, what you're drinking, all that kind of stuff.
Do people have cool food rituals? Because I don't know that I do. That's interesting. I wish I did.
Some people do. Or like we had Crystal Hannah Kim on, who wrote If You Leave Me.
And yeah,
she has candy around, and she drinks Earl Grey tea, but she uses the same tea bag all day. So she's like, by the end of the day, I have like, it's basically a loosely flavored water. You know, people have different things.
I don't, but... What I tried to do for the first time last summer, and especially because Jamie Amberg was doing like the 1,000 words a day thing.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was trying to like boost myself into like some kind of ritual, because I very rarely had one. I'm kind of like a binge writer. Like I won't write for like a long time, then I'll go crazy and then write a lot, then I'll stop again. But for this period of like 3 weeks, I was writing 1,000 words a day, and I was trying to like be like all my wellness type stuff. So I was like meditating in the morning, and I go to the gym. I found there's a spot I'm up in Syracuse, and I stayed up here even during the summer. I usually come down to outside the city where I'm from, Spring Valley, Rockland County. Usually, when I don't have to be up here, I'm down there or in New York City. But I stayed up here to do the writing stuff. And I did discover like this Roji Tea House, which is like kind of became my secret spot because they stay open till like 12, and I may even go there today. They had like a nice lemongrass tea. I would go there late. And like I think I would like bring my computer, my laptop, but not a charger, and try to go until like the charger my computer started dying or they closed. And I'd have like a tea with me only. It'd just be like a tea, and I'd be drinking tea. Maybe I get one, have them re-steep it once. But yeah, so like I don't have a big one, but it is nice if I can get that sort of. I tried to recreate that sort of tea house vibe in my apartment actually the other day, and I like burned some Palo Santo and like.
Oh.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, I do that whole thing.
Well, I'm in California. I'm in LA, so it's very you'd fit right in over here.
That's the thing. Yeah, no, I've become, you know, I got sweet grass, I got Palo Santo, I got sage now. People have given me that stuff, and I've kind of like adopted that whole thing. But it's Syracuse here, so I'm jealous because we don't have the sun, and we're all pretty sad.
Yeah,
but
no, thank you.
Yeah, I do that, and I'll do like my little ginger tea if I can. Ideally I won't be eating. A lot of time I'll be drinking something, not too caffeinated, but a little caffeinated. I'm not big on coffee, but I'll do like the green tea. I used to go to Dunkin' Donuts. That's like that's my old version. I used to live on a street where there was a Dunkin' Donuts. And, I go into the corner and drink my green tea and maybe get like the blueberry donut or whatever it is.
I lived in New York for a while, so I'm familiar with the Dunkin' Donut thing, but I'm a Californian, so it was like that's a very specific part of my life, like Dunkin' Donut time.
Yeah, and the West Coast, you guys take the donuts pretty seriously.
Very
it's like a
serious.
Different thing. I didn't know that until the first time. You guys, like, I know. Yeah, you must look down on Dunkin' Donut donuts. Those are not real donuts, huh?
Yeah, I'm like a very serious donut person. Specifically, me, like donuts are one of my favorite. My brother says my motto is "run and eat donuts" because there was a period of my life where I was training for a marathon, and all I was doing was running and then being like, "Let's get donuts." He was like, "You're just run and eat donuts, girl."
No, I had no idea, but I went to the Bay and like all the things that were open like late night were like donuts. And
yes,
it was, like,
where
was
were you
thing.
In Oakland?
I was at Berkeley and Stanford, but then I was like going to Oakland like when we were at like late night. And yeah. And
you probably went to my donut shop on Lakeshore. I bet that's what you're talking about.
I definitely did because our Uber driver, one time we did an Uber pool and like he like went the other people that came with us end up like this drunk couple. They're like, "We have to go to so-and-so donuts."
Yep.
And the Uber driver was cool and he took us and they went and got some of the gotcha for everybody. And I thought that the donut was cool. I didn't feel like it was like worth all that.
Well, but, I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe it wasn't my place.
It was, I mean, also I didn't get like, there was like one specific donut that they thought was the best. Like they're like, "Oh, this is the best one ever." And they got that one only for themselves. And then for us, we got like the more like pedestrian donuts, I guess. They thought it'd be wasted on us. Anyways, it was like, it was a long line and in the middle of the night. So yeah, I didn't know the donut thing was so West Coast of such a big deal, but I've seen now that it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Oakland and I had like my local donut store did the donuts at my wedding. Like I didn't outsource it to like fancy donuts. I was like, no, someone can pick up the 150 of the donuts that I like from the teeny tiny store that I've been going to since I was in kindergarten every Friday. Like it was very important that I had the correct
donuts.
That's
awesome. Yeah. I like Oakland a lot. I like that Bay Area, especially.
The Bay Area is so great.
especially after being out in Winterfell up here.
Yeah.
I really like the Bay Area.
I don't envy you in late January in Syracuse as far as weather goes, for sure.
It's brutal. It's brutal.
You teach up there, right? You're teaching at Syracuse. Yeah. What's that like? Like, what are you teaching? And what do you, like, how do your students respond to you being like, oh, by the way, I'm just going to pop on to Seth Meyers. And like, by the way, my book is everywhere. And I'm kind of like this amazing new star of literary world.
Last semester I was teaching. And like, that was when everything is very new, you know, for me. Like, right. My book came out came out in October. All this craziness. Late October. So it hasn't been too long yet. But my students were my best cheerleaders, you know. They were pretty excited. On Seth Meyers, for example, I shouted them out in the group chat. They were so happy about that. But, you know, I'm pretty low-key about it. Like, especially up here, like, during this semester, I try to be really present with it, my class. And one of my students made a joke this semester about, like, how come we're not reading this book? Have you heard of it? It's a great book called Friday Black. And I was like, because I hate teachers who teach their own stuff, and I will never do that, you know?
What are you teaching? What's the class?
That class was a reading literature. Like, basically, we're reading a bunch of stuff, and the way I'm kind of gearing it is sort of thinking about how work is, that even may not seem inherently political, sort of political. Just we're reading a bunch of cool stories. We started off, we just had a class, we read Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang, the story that Arrival is based off of,
yes.
The movie Arrival. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, we had such a good discussion. Mm. We had such a great discussion. I felt smarter. My brain kind of hurt from thinking about the nature of free will and time. It was really great. Then I teach a workshop where it's just like, you know, students are going to do their own writing stuff. Then I also teach two sections of Intro to Creative Writing, where it's poetry, fiction, and creative non-writing. And so we just had a great classes in that class as well. We read Skinhead by Patricia Smith, really intense, really dark poetry. And then we listened to this talk by Roger Reeves, who's another great poet, about like sort of what is the work of poetry in this age of sort of brutality. And I had a good week of class, so I'm like kind of gassed about it.
I love that. That's so great. Well, I just have a few more questions for you. One of which is, since your book has gotten like some acclaim and some success and you've been really cool places, and like nothing makes me happier than to see authors getting shine. Yeah. Like, I feel like we don't treat our authors with nearly enough respect, but that's just my own high horse that I'm on. But who's like the coolest person that you've heard from that's expressed interest in your book, or someone that you know read it where you were like, oh my God, I can't believe so-and-so read my book?
There's a couple people now because of like when you start floating your book into Hollywood world, all of a sudden now all these people who like, I can't think of anyone, but I had a really good lunch when I was in LA with Trevante Rhodes, and he was really dope. This is the actor who was just in Bird Box with Sandra Bullock, and he was also in Moonlight.
Right.
And he was just really dope and like just put me on game about that area and the sort of the culture, and that was really cool. Yeah, I don't know. That was a good one. But there's been some other people where I'm just like, whoa, you know. So I don't want to say anyone's name who I haven't confirmed it myself.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
I see. But you've heard some rumors.
I've heard people tell me about people who have read it, and I'm just like, that's something else. But that said, like, you know, when I go on these events and I went to Texas and people have read it in Texas, and I was just floored by that. Anybody reading in Texas, you know.
Right.
So it's all good for me.
I love that. Well, if you were going to recommend another book or a few books to people who have read your book and loved your book, what would you say? Like, where, what direction would you point people? And I know there's a million directions you could go and there's no right answer here. I'm just always curious to hear kind of like what line you might take someone on if they loved your book.
If you liked my book a lot, honestly, like I would say, check out Heads of the Colored People. I would say that first. If you want, like, I don't know, something in my sort of vein, maybe check out, you know, Pastoralia, George Saunders' book, or 10th of December, actually, I guess. Well, I mean, like, after being with my book a lot, I had a lot of fun. These books are definitely not that similar. Fruit of the Drunken Tree by Ingrid Rojas Contreras. I just think it's a beautiful book. As I think is The Incendiaries by R.O. Kwan. Oh, and they're there by Tommy Orange.
Yes.
I think, and She Would Be King is another one. So I think just because those are books that I've been reading recently and I like them, so maybe that might mean that someone who liked my book might like those.
Right. That's like a list of just great 2018 books that came out, right?
Yeah. There's been, and put Crystal Hannah Kim right in that group too.
Yeah. There's been so many amazing debuts by authors of color in 2018 that just like rocked my world. It's been so fantastic.
I mean it seriously. Like I really feel, add My Sister the Serial Killer too. Mm-hmm. I just feel like very, very lucky to be considered peers with these people, you know, the people that you mentioned. And I know them, I've gotten to meet Crystal a couple times. I know
she's
Ingrid.
A doll.
Such a dope, smart, great.
I just loved her. But I have to be honest, everyone I've spoken to kind of that group that you've listed, also Asia Gable was on the show. And
I met her too. She's dope.
She's so cool. Just like so many cool, interesting people. And it's changed the way that I think about authors and writing because it's changed for me as someone who's a reader and not a writer, like pretty heavily not a writer. It changes the way that I think about the work and just that and this group of people, these new young authors who are coming out, that you all have something to say about the world that I live in, but that you're not separate from the world that I live in.
Yeah.
That there's like a humanity between all of us and that authors, because like it's kind of the same thing with actors. Like you think like, oh, actors are famous and they're different. And as someone, you know, authors are kind of like famous people for me as a book lover, but to like actually connect with you all and recognize how you're just putting words, you're just turning this into a certain kind of art and someone else might turn it into another kind of art, but that we're all in the same space and how you guys create these stories has been just unbelievable.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And the thing you're saying, I felt it myself I think, and that's why I kind of like to sort of like, it's funny because you go to these events and people sort of, I don't know, they try to like pamper you, like, do you want the tea? Do you want this? And it's like, I'm a regular, I'm cool, you know, I'm just like everybody else. And I love that this group because they're so welcoming. And again, like for me, like my book came out a little later than all theirs. My book came out late in the year, you know. I think some of them had kind of got to know each other from earlier book stuff. And I you know, they didn't have to be so nice to me, I guess, you know, like, the people that I've met recently, like, yes, I mean, top to bottom, the people, especially this year, but also like outside of that, but like the people I've got to meet like, on the road this past year, their kindness has been crazy. And it's been really great for me because even though we are, especially all very regular people, and that's what I think it kind of gets forgotten the way we think about artists in general. The situation is very specific and now you have a cohort of people who understand what you're going through and that's like invaluable, you know? So so for me, like I was like, oh my God, you're like a normal person. You're like a normal person. And you're like friendly and you're nice, you know? So that whole group of them, I feel very lucky I'm glad my book came out now, you know? Yeah. I feel really lucky about that.
I feel the same way about my podcast because I've been able to talk to so many cool people. I'm like, I'm so glad I started this when I did with all these awesome books coming out.
Yeah, you got a good group. Like they're like, you know, they're cool. Like they're genuinely good people, and I'm, you know, I just feel lucky. And so many of them. Nicole Chung, I want to put her in that group too. Like, you know, just
we're doing her book right alongside yours in February. So.
Oh yeah, yes.
So I'm pumped. Yes. I'm talking to her later this week. So. I can't wait. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And Nana's book is called Friday Black, and we're going to be discussing it on Wednesday. So if you haven't read it yet, read it because we are spoiling it on the show. So make sure you read it and then listen.
Sure, sure.
Nana, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I really do appreciate it. This was fun.
Me too. Thank you. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you for listening to The Short Stacks, and thank you to Nana Kwame Ajay-Brenya for coming on, and thank you to the folks at Mariner Books for giving us a copy of Friday Black. Join us this Wednesday for the Stacks Book Club, where we'll be discussing Friday Black. To help support the Stacks and earn awesome perks, go to patreon.com/thestacks or make one-time contributions at paypal.me/thestackspod. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Kenny Sparks is our sound editor. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegearages. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.